So the Dhamma for today is the Buddha's way of teaching. So not only are the teachings of the Buddha exceptional, but the way in which the Buddha taught was, of course, also exceptional. And the reason for teaching this is because teaching is very much a part of our lives and our practice as Buddhists. Not because we want to teach, not because we aim to teach, but because our interactions with other people demands it. Buddhism is a religion or a practice of exceptionalism. You become exceptional through the practice of the Buddha's teaching. You leave behind ordinary society, ordinary ways of life, and in order to interact with others, you require, it's not about being higher or better or think putting yourself above others. It's about having a certain specificity of your requirements in interacting with others in order to engage with others. There are many things which you find yourself unable to engage in. You can't entertain other people or be entertained by others in the same way anymore. You can't engage in frivolous speech. You just find yourself unable to, uninterested in ordinary ways of behavior. So the most obvious way to interact is to talk about exceptional things, to teach and to discuss and to investigate the truth of reality. So you'll find it remarkable how often you're led to teach and to help others free themselves from ordinary states of stress and suffering that are a part of ordinary worldly life. So being able to teach is valuable, and understanding the right way to teach is a valuable commodity, a valuable quality or skill. So we study and we remember, we reflect on how the Buddha taught. On top of that, it just reminds us of how great the Buddha was, of course, and gives us insight into the nature of the path as we talk about the way in which the Buddha presented the path. So the qualities of the Buddha's manner of teaching are three. The first is that the Buddha's manner of teaching was insightful. The second is that it's irrefutable. And the third is that it's incredible. These are just words that I came up with. I don't have the actual Pali, but taking this teaching, these are three words that just serve as a mnemonic device to help remember the teaching. So the first, that the Buddha's teaching is insightful. The Buddha's manner of teaching is insightful in two ways. First of all, he was insightful in the sense that his teachings delved deeply and fully into the nature of reality. The Buddha's teachings are not superficial. His manner of teaching didn't settle for superficial understanding. He didn't teach simply to find peace or calm as a temporary state of escape. He didn't simply teach many of the things that we find in other spiritual and religious practices. So things like the four Brahma Viharas are a common theme, teaching kindness, teaching compassion. Another common theme is tranquility. The Buddha's teaching goes deeper than ordinary spiritual teachings, which lead people to states of tranquility and relief, and states of a heightened awareness. Even these states of heightened awareness, heightened sense of kindness or compassion, heightened states of focus, concentration. All of these you find in religions outside of the Buddha's teaching, or in spiritual paths outside of the Buddha's teaching. But only in the Buddha's teaching do you find this depth of insight that allows us to see that even positive states are not worth clinging to. Only the Buddha's teaching takes us to the level of impermanence, suffering, and most importantly, non-self. That nothing is us or ours, or worth clinging to, worth holding on to. And this is readily apparent for someone who practices the Buddha's teaching, that it inevitably surprises anyone who isn't already enlightened. That no matter how much you think you've studied and think you've understood about the Buddha's teaching, when you truly experience the truths that he taught, there's a depth of insight there. So when we teach, this is the first part of being insightful, that we have to remember not to water down the teaching, not to give people what they want, but give them what they need, so to speak. To make sure that our teaching is inclusive, that it includes the whole of the Buddha's teaching, basically the Four Noble Truths. There's a story of Sariputta once teaching a Brahmin, and he said, "Oh, well, these Brahmins, they like the Brahma Viharas," and so he taught him the four Brahma Viharas. They want to go to Brahma, so he taught him that. And this man was old and was dying, and when he passed away, he went to the Brahma world. And the Buddha said, "Why didn't you teach him the Four Noble Truths? Or what did you teach him?" He said, "Well, I taught him the four Brahma Viharas." And the Buddha said, "He's been reborn in the Brahma world." And it was an indirect rebuke or criticism. And from then on, they say Sariputta was very careful to never teach without including the Four Noble Truths in his teaching. The second part of being insightful is how the Buddha was insightful into the nature of people. So not only did he give comprehensive teachings, but he was able to direct it to the individual listeners. So he did adjust his teaching, not watering it down and giving people less than what would bring them to complete and true freedom from suffering, but taught it in such a way that the audience would be receptive. And this is a real challenge. It's a real challenge in how we interact with people on an ordinary basis anyway. But to be able to give someone the Dhamma in a way that they can understand it requires some tailoring to their own nature. The Buddha was able to see not only who was capable of understanding the teaching, but the ways in which he would be able to present the teaching that would allow them to understand it and practice it. So we have stories about, the Buddha had exceptional capacity and abilities that allowed him to do this. His ability to see other people's past lives and to see into their minds and get a sense of what they needed to hear. So one monk, he gave him a clean cloth and told him to go and stand in the sun and watch the cloth get dirty from the sweat and the dust as he stood in the sun with this clean cloth. There's various stories where the Buddha was able to give them exactly what they needed. Now, we're inevitably going to fail at this. Our ability to teach and to help and to present the teachings to others is never going to be on that level. But it's important to remember and to understand that custom teachings and being able to direct your teachings to the audience is always going to be very important, especially when you're talking one-on-one to the individual and giving them instruction in meditation and that sort of thing. The second quality of the Buddha's teaching, being irrefutable, refers to how the Buddha taught based on cause and effect. He didn't ask people to just accept his teachings at face value. He never presented things as not being capable of investigation or susceptible to investigation. He always taught based on cause and effect. His teachings on dependent origination show this quite clearly. When he discusses the nature of suffering, and he points that the problem in the world is, at a very basic level, simply suffering. He didn't just say there is suffering, he didn't just say follow my teachings and you'll be free from suffering. He gave a very detailed analysis of how suffering arises. And then he talked about the one and only way in which suffering can cease, and that's through the cessation of delusion, of ignorance. With the cessation of ignorance, that is the key to freeing one from suffering, to ending one's experience of suffering. And he didn't just say, you know, believe me in this. He provided causes and he provided cause and effect arguments as to how this came about. If you look at it, the very core of the Buddha's teaching, it's essentially a pair of causes and effects. Craving being the cause of suffering, and the Eightfold Noble Path, or these practices basically, in briefs, ethics, concentration and wisdom, being the path that leads to freedom from suffering. So in our teachings, in the Buddha's teachings and in the teachings when we present them, it's obviously very important to be able to provide this causal relationship, that we don't just present teachings, practice this way, do what I tell you, that we're able to explain and present the teachings in a way that makes them logical and related to reality, that they have a verifiable quality to them, that a person is able to investigate and see for themselves that X does lead to Y, and the absence of X means the absence of Y, for example. This comes into effect when we try to teach people the practice of mindfulness, because again, it's on a deeper level from ordinary meditation practices. Ordinary meditation, you could give any sort of meditation object. If you read the books in New Age circles, these books on creative visualization, it's infinite, the number of different types of meditation that you can think up. And it doesn't really matter because it's all conceptual. And any sort of concept, many such concepts are going to be conducive to tranquility. And so ordinary meditation doesn't require this level of exactitude, because it doesn't deal with the ultimate reality, which is singular. You can't make up some framework by which to understand ultimate reality, because ultimate reality is the way it is. It doesn't change. If you're doing creative visualization, if you're doing any kind of tranquility meditation, you know, the Buddha, in the Buddhist text, there's 40 different meditation types, but there could be many more. And there are many more outside of the Buddha's teaching. Conceptual reality allows for that. But in the practice of mindfulness, there's required a certain amount of exactitude. So first of all, there are only a certain number of things that you can pay attention to, and we have to be able to explain to people why they can't note, for example, if they hear a dog barking, why they can't say dog, dog, dog. Because dog isn't, no matter how much you try to make it so, it isn't a part of ultimate reality, meaning it isn't a part of what you experience. Your experience is always going to be hearing at the ear. Or if you see a dog, it's going to be seeing. Dog doesn't actually arise in that moment, it arises afterwards in the mind, when the mind processes and conceives of the dog, for example. We have to explain to people why we're noting in the first place. So we have to be able to describe the process by which the mind cultivates this state of sati. So we have to explain how the mind works when it recognizes something, and then normally it will react and judge and proliferate, make more out of the experience than it actually is, and how we try to redirect that and prevent that by reiterating, reminding ourselves of the actual experience. When hearing, you say, when you repeat to yourself, hearing, we have to be able to explain that as a cause for the effect that we're trying to attain, which is sati, which is the grasping of the object just as it is, without any proliferation, without any extrapolation. And then we have to explain why that is valuable. Why should that be a valuable state? What does that do for us? We have to explain how it allows us to see the experience and why seeing the experience is important, seeing it as it is, seeing it clearly. We have to explain that the things that we see are not a problem. It's not wrong that when you do this, you're going to suddenly feel like everything is chaotic, impermanent, unsatisfying, uncontrollable. Because quite often when a meditator begins to see these things, it's quite disagreeable. And they feel like this practice is unbeneficial, it's harmful, because it's leading to the exact things that we never want to see at all. The three characteristics: no one ever wants to see impermanence. No one ever wants to meet with everything being unsatisfying or uncontrollable. So we have to explain these things. We have to explain from beginning to end. The ability to explain this is an important part of the teaching. So it requires study, and it requires experience. It requires you to have gone through this and being able to relate it from your own experience with confidence. The third quality of the Buddha's teaching is that it's incredible. And this refers simply to the remarkable fact that when one practices the Buddha's teaching, when the Buddha teaches someone, they change, they succeed. It's almost as though they're under his spell. There was this other sect in the Buddha's time that's recorded in the texts, and they actually started making this claim that the Buddha had some converting magic, that it didn't really matter who it was. Anyone who went to see the Buddha, no matter how staunchly they were against the Buddha's teaching or in favor of a different teacher, they said he had some kind of magic, that all he had to do was talk to them, and no matter who it was, would convert immediately to Buddhism. What it means is that they would understand and appreciate his teachings. What it means is that they would change based on the new insight and wisdom that he gave, that his teaching was powerful and effective. And this is important. It's quite possible for you to present all of the Buddha's teaching all correctly, but have no effect on the actual listeners. The audience will not ingest it, will not appreciate it. And this goes back to understanding the nature of the audience and being able to know and penetrate into the nature of their minds, what they need to hear, giving them what they need to hear, and providing them with the lesson that would actually be of value to them. The Buddha was exceptional at this. The Buddha's ability to not only know what people needed to hear, but have the ability to present it to them, to have the oratory skill and to have the wisdom and depth of mind, presence of mind, to be able to provide it to the audience. This is another aspect that we're always going to fail in. We're always going to have students who fail because of our inadequacy in teaching, fail because of their own inadequacy that we just don't see. Maybe we give them a teaching that's really a good teaching for someone else, but is not the teaching that this person needs to hear. Of course, we won't even be able to recognize if a person is necessarily be able to recognize whether a person is able to realize the teachings at all. There are some people in the world who just, their minds are in a very wrong way. People who come to practice for the wrong reasons, can be very difficult to teach them. And our inability to see that and to understand that is always going to get in our way. It can be quite discouraging as well. And I guess The first lesson is to not let it discourage you, that ultimately we're not responsible for other people's enlightenment. We're responsible for our own actions. And this is why I present teaching as just a part of life. It doesn't have to be effective. As with all things in our Buddhist practice, we can never focus on the results, the actual results, because they're very much out of our control. Even when we practice meditation, it's not going to be a linear practice or progress of constant improvement, constantly improving your life. It's going to be mixed with all sorts of bad results that come from other causes, because life is complicated. A person might dedicate them to the practice and still experience a lot of suffering, still experience a lot of defilement. They might say, here I am practicing to get rid of greed, get rid of anger, get rid of delusion, and it just keeps coming back. This is because life is complicated. We are complicated. We have a lot of bad habits that we can't just erase. And the same goes for our interactions, even more so with our interactions with others. We can't expect that even though we put the right foot forward, do our best to try to express the teachings as best we know how, and it can still be completely ineffective. And this is simply due to our inadequacies, the audience's inadequacies, and many, many other factors that just result in an ineffectual teaching. Nonetheless, this is of course an important lesson for us to remember, that we can't just be satisfied with presenting the teachings. You do find in Buddhist cultures this habit of repeating the teachings by rote. Often you'll hear monks give Dhamma talks and they just say the same thing. In Thailand, there was one monk who was infamous for this in my monastery, an old monk. And someone said to me, every time he gives a talk, it's exactly, almost word for word, the exact same talk. It was like he wasn't even really trying. And it wasn't all that effective either. And this is actually quite common and something you don't want to get into. You don't want to get into saying, well, I'm presenting the teachings just as I've learned them. That's great and that's important. It's important that you don't deviate from the true teachings. But it's also important, of course, that you do your best and that you have the intention and the inclination to try to pass on the teachings. Not hoping or wishing for the person to get good results, that's out of your hands, but doing your honest best and having an honest and sincere inclination that not only should I present the truth, but that I should present it in a way that is helpful for the people listening. This is the way we see that the Buddha was able to teach. It's one of his great qualities. Not only did he know the truth, but that he was able to express it to others. It's what makes a fully enlightened Buddha distinct from a Pacheka Buddha. Because there are individuals with less, what we call less perfections, who were able to realize the teachings, the truth for themselves without a teacher. But they don't have this capacity of the Buddha to be able to present them to others. They didn't have the understanding and the depth of wisdom to be able to put the teachings into words. Now we, of course, are in a different situation. We have the teachings all in front of us. Our challenge is to be able to understand them beyond simple faith and confidence in the Buddha, to do our best to try to realize the teachings for ourselves, and to the extent that we're able and to the extent that we're called to it, to share these teachings with others and help them to realize the teachings for themselves. So that's the Dhamma for today.